Well, because my take on modernity, if you like, and my take on secularization as an aspect of modernity, is that it is, you can't have a single judgment on it, that there are great gains and there are at the same time great losses. I mean, that's part of the reason why I just can't take this very optimistic Enlightenment scenario of things get better and better, right? But I don't take the reactionary scenario, things are getting worse and worse.
Rethinking religion.
I'm Norris J. Chumley. Today on Rethinking Religion from Columbia University's Institute for Religion, Culture, and Public Life, we're featuring an in-depth conversation with philosopher Charles Taylor, longtime professor of political science and philosophy at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, where he's now professor emeritus. Charles Taylor has written widely on Hegel, Wittgenstein, Heidegger, and Merleau-Ponty. His more recent book, A Secular Age, published by Harvard University Press, has gained him vast recognition and many awards, including the Templeton Prize and the Kyoto Prize in 2008. Charles Taylor is in conversation with Akhil Bilgrami, Johnsonian Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Heyman Center for the Humanities at Columbia University.
Let me begin by asking you something about your intellectual development, and ask about how in the 60s, I believe, or late 50s, you had very serious leftist commitments, political commitments. You were one of the founders of what later came to be called the New Left Review, and throughout this, you had deep religious commitments as well. And so I'm particularly interested in that mix of commitments, especially since I imagine some of your colleagues in the New Left Review were quite militantly anti-religious. And so how did you to sort of survive in that atmosphere, and what were your own ways of integrating these two seemingly diverse commitments?
Well, Akhil, there was no problem surviving because Rhee was very open. The New Left Review was started, you know, after the Suez debacle in 56, and at the same time the communist movement was beginning to, you know, fracture after everything that happened in the Soviet Union. And so the idea was, let's have a very open discussion in which all kinds of ways of being on the left can be put on the table. So nobody, if anybody had said, I mean, don't present that point of view, that's really off the table, that would have been considered a grave fault, right? So we were allowed to be what we wanted to be from our own point of view, and there were a certain number of people who came to this from a Christian perspective, and Alistair MacIntyre, of course, we were colleagues then. At the same time, because there are these very rich traditions, you know, think of the labor movement in England, right? The labor movement in England became for a time very Marxist, but it was originally very powerfully Methodist as well, right? And the Methodism that fed into the trade union movement and so on. In my case, there is a whole school or developing schools of thinking, mainly come out of French Catholicism, which of course had a tremendous impact in Quebec. See, I was brought up in a kind of outreach of French Catholic thinking in all levels. I mean, the reactionaries were there, but also people around the magazine Esprit with Mounier and so on, right? So the people, the media from which came worker priests later on and so on. Right? So there were these very strong intellectual traditions, and we were sort of allowed, I mean, everyone was willing to listen to everything. So most people were Marxist, but I wasn't really Marxist. In the end, a lot of in common with Marx, but I wasn't really Marxist. So I made these long disquisitions about what was wrong with Marxism, and then I was answered, and so on. And that was thought to be the what we were trying to do in this movement. You see, it was a very, very good moment in which the level of dogmatic closedness had really been done.
Right. So what were the aspects of Marxism that you found yourself sort of excluding from your leftist commitments, and what did you want to add to Marxism that made it a more humane kind of left?
Yeah, I mean, basically, one thing was its incredible, if you like, Enlightenment optimism, that we just need to change these institutional structures and then all the terrible things that made human beings attack, you know, each other in the past will disappear. And the obverse side of that, the very dangerous obverse side of that, is that if you do believe that, you don't have to go on, but you can easily go on to believe that whatever ruthless steps are necessary to take in order to make these changes are worth it, because after all, when they're made, these terrible legacy and history of human conflict and so on will disappear. So I was, of course, tremendously critical there, mainly of the mainstream communist movement. And that was, you know, that was relatively well received, because the new left, as a way, started because a lot of people, maybe in the Labour Party, but were fed up with the Labour Party's various compromises. And a lot of people had been in the Communist Party, but had really left the Communist Party.
Right.
I mean, Edward Thompson and people like that. See, so people were willing to discuss.
Yeah. But on the intellectual new left, quite apart from its institutional and party links and responses to political parties and so on, there were people like Althusser, presumably, who were very different from...
Yes, they were not yet powerful on the scene. That was interesting.
That came later.
That, the Marx that was people were still willing to consider very seriously, and I was a little bit into that because, you know, if you wanted to consider any Marx, it would have to be for me this one, was more humanist, inspired by Lukács, not simply a reductive explanation of history in terms of the economy, but rather looking at, if you like, the way in which, well, Merleau-Ponty, who was a very important figure for me in the French scene, but philosophically, had also had his Marxist phase in which he presented this view of Marxism. Althusser was the diametric opposite of that. It was really structural system, leaving no room for human choice.
Right.
Everybody has an ideology, as against the Marxist idea that people who have ideologies haven't yet, you know, seen their own. And it was very interesting that shortly after the first team resigned, not in anger, but we all went and did other things in 1961, the first team of editors, the new second team came in, which is still, in a sense, there, Perry Anderson and Robin Blackburn and so on, and they took up Althusser in a very big way.
I see.
And this caused, I mean, I wasn't much on the scene, but Edward Thompson was extremely pained and angry. But in a certain sense, first of all, because the stance of that kind of Marxist leftism was highly intellectualistic, highly unconnected with the particular labor movements, right? It was all, so you had to read Gramsci in the Italian and Marx in the German and so on. I'll just say in the French, and you had to be in a kind of international discussion. Edward Thompson, as the historian of the English working class movement, had this immense admiration for it, but also couldn't stomach any kind of reductive Marxism, because he saw the creation of the labor movement is something in which human agency played an absolutely crucial role, and there was, contributions from Methodism and everything. It wasn't something that just could be rolled out from looking at the base, you know, that this had to happen.
Right.
So he, and these two grounds, and he wrote this savage attack on, you know, poverty of theory and so on. So there was a rift, but at that point, the atmosphere of open exploration had already a little bit, you know, thinned out.
In this recent book of yours, Circular Age, in your criticisms of modernity, what you in a chapter call the malaise of modernity and so on, there's a lot of focus on notions of disenchantment and alienation in the modern world, which are really very Marxist notions in a way, I mean alienation especially. But do you think its critique of modernity since the early modern period and the constructions that you described in such detail could be part of a progressive left critique, or do you think it really has now moved, you've moved away from that to a quite different trajectory of...
No, I think on the contrary, I mean, it could very much be, because, why? Well, because my take on modernity, if you like, and my take on secularization as an aspect of modernity is that it is, you can't have a single judgment on it, that there are great gains and there are at the same time great losses. I mean, that's part of the reason why I just can't take this sort of very optimistic enlightenment scenario, okay, things get better and better, right? But I don't take the reactionary scenario, things are getting worse and worse. So it is really trying to discriminate what we can't avoid having in our present age. I mean, some kind of individualism, some kind of importance of identity, or you can name a number of things. And what is, what important things that we may have lost, we have to recreate, and things that we consider as gains. So there are things you can't change, but some aspects of them are clear gains. And I think that has to be the background for a left critique of where the society is at. So, I mean, for instance, the issue of solidarity. What are the bases of solidarity? Are we sawing away? I mean, are we, I don't know, what image are we undermining the bases of solidarity in our society so that you can have this whittling away of the welfare state, whittling away of mutual responsibility, the kind of thing that caused this debate about the the health scheme in America and so on. Those kinds of issues, we need to recover the sources of mutual solidarity. And right, that's an extremely important issue that right, the left has to raise.
Right. So let's just, since it's so current and topical, let's take the attitudes that one finds surfacing over the healthcare debate and ask... what's being exploited is fears. I mean, there seems to be no doubt that a lot of people who are relatively well off will have to make sacrifices if people who have no healthcare and all are to be included in. Mm. And there's just maybe higher taxes. Yeah. There may just more commitments and what the right is doing is actually to strike fear in people, that they are going to actually be paying more and so on. Do you think that all of these attitudes of, I suppose, could summarily be described as the selfishness of our time, which can be so easily tapped by the right, is really continuous with the loss of what the kinds of losses of the secular age or the modern age,
mm-hmm,
and that it may require just the solidarities that are required to go back might involve some form of you know, not orthodox religion, but some kind of religious,
mm-hmm,
very broadly understood return to a religious basis for solidarity.
Well, there has to be, I mean, there has to be a common acceptance of the importance of solidarity, but this is in a present type of society, this has to be fed into by this person or group thinks of it in religious terms, this person or group thinks of it in Marxist terms, etc., etc. But certainly, among the resources for certain people coming to this are their religious traditions, and mm-hmm, that's important,
yes,
to not to exclude, as it were. I think that's unimportant to start with.
Right.
But definitely the whole nature of the society we're living in frays the bonds of solidarity, right?
And
no one wants to pay more taxes. But how powerful is the other motivation,
right,
that we're living beside these people? And we have to avert our eyes all the time because it's terribly uncomfortable to see the conditions that they're living in. So we'd rather live in a gated community and so on. I mean, see, that's that other thing that is pulling people in that other direction.
You're listening to Rethinking Religion. Our interview continues with Charles Taylor, Canadian-born philosopher, political historian, and author of A Secular Age. He's in conversation with Akhil Bilgrami.
So one of the things that interests me a lot about your diagnosis of modern society, Chuck, is that there is a great feeling on your part that even if one were to think of the basis of solidarity in purely secular terms, it would be odd, given your analysis of how we have come to a secular age, to think that these bases are in some way going to be, if there's a recovery of solidarity and it has a secular basis, it would be, given your analysis, ought to be continuous with something in the religious. Mm-hmm. Right? That it should be possible to say that the secular is continuous with something in the religious. And yet there are whole movements like the whole sort of 400-page books by people like Dawkins and Hitchens who say that it's precisely completely unnecessary to see it as continuous with the religious, right? That this is a holy, you can be, full of sympathy and solidarity, entirely independent of it. Mm-hmm. But given the historical analysis you provide, I assume, but maybe I'm wrong, that there's some feeling on your part that these would be continuous with religious tradition.
Well, for some people, they would be continuous. Yeah. Right? I don't dispute Dawkins, Hitchens' idea that you can have people who are totally non-religious, anti-religious, and who have very strong ethical commitments and can be part of the, we hope, majority that would support this kind of solidarity. But what astonishes me is the idea that only this philosophical basis can, whereas plainly there are many possible philosophical bases. Of course, and then there are people who have a very deep religious view who are working against that for a variety of, I think, misguided reasons. But there are people with very atheist views. Right. They're also working against that. They don't want to pay more taxes. And so to me, it's an attempt to raise this issue as a central issue and divide. Actually, it will have the effect of dividing people who ought to be natural allies. And it's based on a strange set of illusions. I mean, the main thing they keep saying is that religion is dangerous, it produces violence. Well, of course it does in certain cases, right? But it also, the opposite. I mean, you had people, in India at the time of the partition who were calling on their co-religionaries to go and massacre the other side of it. Then you have Gandhi, which saved, anyway, Bengal from probably the fate that occurred in Punjab. Right. So what do you do? And then you have on the atheistic side, you have people like Stalin and Pol Pot who are organizing mass killings, and then you have other people.
The liberation.
But you have other people who are just as much atheists or just as much agnostics, but have played a very honorable role in putting an end to some of these conflicts. So that's the interesting thing, the interesting issue about human beings is what turns them to violence. And the idea that it's simply some belief or other, which is shared on both sides. I mean, a lot of Christians I know say, I mean, of course, it's atheists like Stalin and Hitler. I mean, naturally, they had no more limitation on themselves, therefore they killed everybody. And then you say, well, how about Torquemada? And so they're kind of stuck. And then you have Dawkins and Hitchens who are saying Torquemada. You say, how about Stalin? And Dawkins says, oh, he was an atheist, but that had nothing to do with it. I can say, Torquemada's a Catholic. It's a kind of illusion here that if you get people to believe the right thing, the problem will be solved. Whereas plainly what drives people to this, I fully don't understand. I mean, anybody who did this must be self-deluded. But there's a deep question there, which we should all try to look at. The first move in this is setting aside these total non-solutions.
So let me ask you to briefly just say a few words about very alluring phrases you've used to summarize important concepts and whole ways of thinking. So I'll begin by asking you what you mean by the malaise of modernity, and then go on to two or three other key concepts in the book, and then maybe we can get a sense of the larger picture.
Well, actually, the problem was with that, I let my publisher get away with something. The original lectures had malaise in the plural, you see. And it ended up when the that short book, which is the lectures, the Massey lectures, CBC does talk about three, but the the book ended up with a, mm-hmm. and I guess publishers have beliefs about what sells books, and they don't make it look complex. Anyway, so, I mean, so there are a set of malaises around the whole issue of meaning. Plainly, you know, being in a secular age, being in an age in which a lot of the things that people have found meaning in have been, for some people, debunked, for others not, can pose for any individual at a given time a real sense of, you know, what is there. And that's why we're living in a world with such a large number of seekers, searchers, people looking for mm-hmm. some. That's why when you take these polls, Pew polls, what do you believe in? A lot of people say no religion, but they don't turn out to be simple atheists in most cases. They turn out to be people who are looking, right?
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that certainly arises. And the other is this sense of fraying of the social fabric, right? What Tocqueville was talking about, how the individual's interest in his or her own life can undo some of the right. some of the social fabric, with all the malaise that go along with that, but also all the dangers for the society. And these are two very, very big set of issues that...
yes. There's a key concept you use of a buffered self, and I assume that's linked in some ways to the great changes in early modernity.
Yes.
So do you want to say just a bit about that? Because I think people who will go on to read the book will be keen to get some of these terms.
Yeah. Well, that is about what I call disenchantment. But you see, what I'm calling enchantment in the book, and this word is used in lots of ways, and it's invented by Weber in a certain sense, right? Max Weber. And he himself used it in lots of ways, but then one way came to be the one that people think of as Weber, which is a general decline of religion. But actually, one of the ways Weber uses it most interestingly is to describe a turn in religion, which you see, for instance, with the Protestant Reformation, where... The Christian tradition turns around and attacks various cults and ways of dealing with spirits and so on, which were part of the popular religion, right. but are now considered out. This is dangerous, right? I mean, interestingly, there used to be an idea of good magic and bad magic, white magic and black magic, and for the reformers, all magic is black magic. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that had a profound effect. I think we become different kinds of people. If you read anthropology about situation in modern Africa and so on, the presence of spirits and powers is very real for those people, right?
Yes.
A threat, sometimes threatening, sometimes not threatening. The Christian, not so much the missionaries, because they're Europeanized at the beginning, but the ones who are native Christians are very often fighting against these yeah. because they see them as diabolical.
Right.
It's pretty impossible to get that kind of rise out of a modern, Western, advanced society. I mean,
yes.
people now go to horror movies with ghosts and spooks right. and get a frisson.
Right.
Can you imagine in the 1500 right. you want to open Rosemary's Baby playing? I mean, the people say, this is real stuff. I mean, don't... You know.
That's really funny.
So we become a different kind of human being. It's an yeah. interesting thing in history.
Right.
We have certain insensitivity, because I think there is something that these people were on about.
Right.
They had an acute sensibility to.
Right. So the self that is buffered from what otherwise, prior to what created the buffering, just responsive to meanings and values and so on, which were part of, you know, if you like to call it that, a magical understanding
yeah.
of the natural environment. Of,
that's right.
And so if I understand you, the idea of a buffered self was an idea of a self that generated value and meaning all by itself, rather than
not necessarily, because it could be a very pious person who thought that meaning and value was generated by God.
But it was the providential.
Yeah.
But the
world around them
yes.
went silent.
That's Charles Taylor, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy and Political History at Montreal's McGill University. And this is the radio audio series, Rethinking Religion. Charles Taylor is in conversation with Columbia University Professor of Philosophy, Akhil Bilgrami, who is also director of the Heyman Center for the Humanities. We'll return to their conversation in a moment. There are several lectures that Professor Charles Taylor has given at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Democracy, Toleration, and Religion available at our website. Please visit ircpl.org. We also have a blog where you may add your own ideas. Please check it out.
The Romantics felt this terrible loss, so they try to recover something, but they never recover that kind of spontaneous, even naive, immediate sense. They keep talking about, you know, read Wordsworth. I mean, this idea of a great movement through all things, the spirit that moves, and so on. They're trying to reinvoke that in poetry, but it's not something that just everybody feels. That's why I say everything has gains and losses, and then you try to recover what's lost in a new way. Well, that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to recover what they thought was terribly lost, and in a different way. You see, what's interesting about the whole Romantic thing, from this point of view, is you look through all the great writers, right? You know, Wordsworth, Coleridge, and then Shelley, and then you look at Schlegels and Herder, and so on. And what you find is that they don't have a fundamental agreement on the deep ontology. Some of them remain orthodox. I mean, Wordsworth re-became orthodox, Friedrich Schlegel became a Catholic, and so on. Others, like Shelley, remain profoundly non-orthodox, even atheistic, right? Okay, so what they share is some sense of this, some more powerful thing moving here, okay? And in order to get what they all share, you have to use extremely vague terms, right? But there is something very powerful in this world that is not captured by natural science. Some of them think of that in the traditional transcendent terms, tradition of God. Some of them don't. So that's why I say that what's interesting about this whole movement is that there new languages are developed in which you can talk about this, which don't have clear and final ontological commitments. I mean, interesting fact, Wordsworth's poetry was taken up by George Eliot. It was taken up by, you know, perfectly orthodox people. George Eliot was, it was taken up by just every kind of position you can imagine in the 19th century were inspired by Wordsworth. Now, that says something about a sort of level of thinking and sensibility which somehow isn't clearly placed in the secular sacred opposition. I mean, individuals may place themselves, but that kind of thinking is... It isn't clearly belonging to this,
it is or this
or to that. It leaves this space open, and that's the fascinating thing about it.
And part of the malaise that you described, and the whole Weberian understanding of modernity, talks of alienation and disenchantment. And I'm wondering if the deepest thing about being unalienated is, you know, apart from the sophisticated, detailed things that Marx talks of, but the much deeper point, which really is sort of taken for granted, I'm assuming, by Marx, is that to be unalienated is to be at home in the world, right? To not be an alien in the world. So the most elementary and fundamental form of being unalienated is to not see the world as something that our subjectivity must control. And it's a sort of Heideggerian and Gandhian ways of thinking. It's not something that is alien and therefore to be controlled, but actually makes demands with us, which in our responses, if we are in sync with them, then we are unalienated. And so this would be the most elementary redress of the alienation that comes from disenchantment, which refuses to see the world. So is that something that you think would be
the first, of course not the most sophisticated and detailed forms of an unalienated life, which have to do with labor and capital and what it makes of the world around us, but a much more basic thing.
Yes, I mean, this other one that you're talking about has to be brought into the equation too, and we have to see how they fit together. You see, for someone like Marx, it's what you need to do is to revolutionize the social relations, and then you overcome alienation. And that's not entirely untrue for Hegel too. You see, with the idea of the sich empfindeter Geist, the self-alienated spirit, is something that belongs to a certain epoch because the world was profoundly out of sync, right? But what you're saying is there must be a deeper level, right, in which that we talk about humans in the natural world and not simply these and those human beings in the social world. Must be a deeper level at which it can't just all be projected by us. We have to be, in some sense, responding to. Right? And so the whole issue of alienation really depends on taking your general context question and looking at all these proposals to alter society and how they fit together. Right. But you see, Marx completely fails to answer that broader thing. He sees it all as something
because of the materialism.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right. Though I should remind you that there are three very fascinating pages on Marx and alienation in Abrams's book, Natural Supernaturalism, where in very obscure ways he almost sees the point that he would have to build on this more basic thing. He doesn't say it, but I think he sort of got it somehow.
Yeah, because you see the big issue there, and that's where Althusser came in.
Exactly.
You can see very clearly in early Marx, he's deeply moved by this romantic.
Exactly.
And in some of the unpublished manuscripts, there are plain references to the way we, the human way of being in the world, of enjoying the world. You can see this whole issue of a range of meanings there. Right? And then what comes out in Das Kapital is really quite hard-nosed. It's responding to a climate of late Victorian science, Darwin, and so on. So the question is, did Marx totally leave that behind?
Right.
And Althusser said he did.
Right.
But what he didn't take account of is in the 1860s, the 1850s, you have the Grundrisse, where you still have this language. So Marx himself must have been uncertain about this. That is, he moved to a presentation of his position that didn't rely on that at all.
Right.
And Engels was tone deaf about this.
That's right.
from the very beginning.
Right.
But, you know, early Marx was a German romantic in many, many important respects.
Right. Let me switch subjects just a little bit, not entirely. As you say, I think you announced right at the beginning of your book that you're going to study religion and secularism only within the context of Latin Christendom, and really they're even in the North Atlantic region.
Even that isn't fully covered.
Right. And I'm curious a little bit about, in these descriptions of the emergence of a secular age in this large site, how comprehensive was the reach of this in other parts of the world? So, you know, it's very interesting when Gandhi, who was an essentially religious person, was writing in 1908, he wrote Hind Swaraj, he really had the sense that India was at just the cusp that England, the colonial master, and Europe generally, was in the late 17th century, what you describe in the providential deist stuff and so on. So he had this idea that there are parts of the world, India, for instance, which was at that cusp. And he was filled with anxiety about how people around him, who even if they were religious, wanted this modernity for India and thought it was inevitable. And he was filled with anxiety, and it's fascinating to see that exactly these anxieties were there amongst a lot of dissenters who were seeing the direction in which it was happening in England and in Europe. And, you know, Jonathan Israel and others have described these dissenters as the radical enlightenment, etc. Yeah. So it's very interesting that Gandhi had all the instincts that these dissidents had, these dissenters had. And he really thought they were in the same situation. So, but all that leads me to ask you, if we can talk of re-enchantment today, or if we can talk of putting constraints on the spread of disenchantment at any rate, if we can talk of tiny reversals here and there, rather than, nobody can turn it all bad, of course, but to the extent that we can talk of reversals of this kind, how comprehensive do you think the reach of these changes that you describe as emerging in early modernity are in the world, and how shall we begin to think of resistances to its spread in those parts where it hasn't reached? It's very hard to think about all this because, of course, it's different in different parts of the world and so on. But do you have any optimism about this? Do you have a sense of its scope?
Well, you have to be very optimistic because the alternative is just terribly dire. But it's not simple. I mean, for instance, I can't really buy the Hind Swaraj program, which is going to stop the train. I mean, literally, but let people go on living in these local communities with a certain sense of what their neighbors are, roughly the same technology and so on. I mean, in theory, it works wonderfully. In practice, people desire some of the things that you get from communications and are going to want them and so on. So the question is, how can you have this, as it were, advance in technology, communication technology, travel and technology, and so on, and yet retain a certain sense that the world we live in makes claims on us. Right? Now, I think that is not as difficult now as it were it was 50 years ago, because we see a disaster for us, right? I mean, and people, it's not just that people are moved by a sense of we're all going to have no air to breathe, that's very strong utilitarian, but that the whole prestige of this mode of life has been undercut by the fact that it has no answer for this. Right? So, and then you get people flying off with Gaia hypotheses and so on and so on. So from that point of view, I'm not totally pessimistic.
So you think there's something in the ecological movement which is really seeing the malaise of modernity as a very vivid thing.
Yes, and as our having, as you would put it, failed to see that there are certain demands on us. There are certain objective meanings of things that we have been just screening out.
Right.
You know, we walk into the forest and it's all, we just see it as a lot of lumber.
The conversation you're listening to on today's Rethinking Religion was recently recorded at Columbia University's Institute for Religion, Culture, and Public Life. You can download this entire program, as well as transcripts, other lectures by Taylor, and an array of leading philosophers, writers, journalists, and artists at our website, ircpl.org.
So you have some optimism that the self-consciousness about ecology that is emerging might be optimistic, but might give us grounds to be optimistic. But it would depend on the extent to which the ecology is seen as what some people have called deep ecology, right? That it's not just a matter of just, nature in a self-standing sense, but nature as involving a whole set of human attitudes.
And making demands, a certain
demand. And making demands on us, and therefore transforming human relations, the relations between its inhabitants, and not just human beings in relation to the environment, but human beings in relations to each other, and a whole history and tradition that the whole thing creates. And so that may be will give us a way of thinking about the scope for re-enchantment.
And even some Gandhian themes are re-emerging. I mean, people talk about, slow food movement, and then the other aspect of that, you should eat nothing grown beyond 5 kilometers from where you are. I mean, it's an idea of depending on the immediate surrounding resources against all. And a lot of people are trying to adopt this, now try to, as a way, stop the train. Right. So you see some of those Gandhian insights, the possible destructiveness of just, and they're working out in the way people organize their lives and not simply in voting for, we hope, ecological policies. I mean, greenhouse gas
There's a question that I'd be curious to know your view about. You know, these things, and this takes us to the relationship between religion and politics to some extent. You know, these things require movements, mm-hmm. because governments and policymakers and certainly corporations don't listen to anything but a certain amount of pressure.
Yeah.
Corporations and governments are basically dispositions in a way. They're disposed to get profit or promote the interests of their nation or whatever it is. And they're not rational beings. So you have to put pressure on them because they're nothing but forces. So there's to be sort of counter forces. And those always have come from movements. You know, I mean, all the major changes in this country have come from movements, you know, labor legislation movements in the 30s, civil rights and so on in the 60s. So a lot of this requires movements. But the thing is that the kinds of malaise you've been talking about, which is of atomization and fragmentation of our lives, makes it very much harder to start a movement than it was even in the 60s. You know, and certainly, you know, because we've things to do, and I like, you know, so I go to a meeting once in a month, and then I go to a meeting the next month. But nothing, you know, it's very hard to keep it up, to organize, to get people together, because our lives are fragmented. You know, we've just got things to do which are so fragmented, and it's part of the kinds of loss that you were describing that comes with modernity. So it's very hard to build the kind of thing. So you have great writers on ecology, you have a few people, you know, economists and others warning us, but the kinds of changes that come from movements so it's sort of double whammy, as it were. You know, you've got the malaise, and the malaise it's part of the malaise that it prevents movements to resist it.
Except that, I mean, that's part of the truth. The other part of the truth is this very malaise can make people be ready to join movement when it comes along, right? So, I mean, the Obama thing, I hope this isn't, you know, going to be a flash in the pan and it won't disappear and people won't be depressed and go away. But that's very impressive because using that technology, it got lots of people that were isolated before together. And some of them actually turned out and helped, but some of them just sent in their dollar or they talked to their friends or whatever, right?
That's true.
And they formed part of a big movement and they actually altered the pattern of voting from what it otherwise would have been.
Right.
Now, I'm just terrified that they're going to feel that they're not, because, you know, they didn't perhaps realize how hard it was going to be to change some of these things and how entrenched, you know.
But it was a movement, you say.
It was a movement. It was definitely a movement. Right. It changed politics. Right. It was a real movement politics. What I want to do is I want to talk about reductionism, which, I mean, is the issue of human explanation, right? And I want to talk about two kinds of reductionism which could go in different directions, but which can also be in some kind of synergy. One is the attempt to take, you know, the, if you like, the goals of a human being that aren't obviously economic and to do with life and the reproduction of life, goals at the level of morality and aesthetics and so on, and in some way take them down a peg. Take them down a peg in terms of causal explanation. I mean, kind of vulgar Marxism, history is really moved by the economic demands and not by moral demands. But also take them down a peg, and this is where connection to Akhil's work, by declaring them to be simple projections. I mean, they're not reactions to real properties, but things we project. The other kind of reduction is the attempt at an explanation of human action, which we normally talk of in terms of purposes, goals, working out how to get, etc., in purely mechanistic terms. In other words, in terms that are fit with natural science in the post-Galilean period, where you have efficient causation is the only thing, right? So you get various movements, you know, like the present attempt to understand the human mind in terms of computer models and so on, right? And how these two could be different. I mean, there are certain kinds of Marxism that want to do the first kind, but don't. But Marxists who look disparagingly on mechanistic materialism, right? Materialism is a key word here for both of them, as against dialectical materialism. So they split the two. But there's a way in which they're in synergy. So I want to take, you know, people like Dennett and Steve Pinker and so on as my example of the synergy. And I want to explain the synergy. I want to explain how If you buy into the second type of reduction, pure explanation in terms of fish and causation, you cannot but declare all those meanings in morals and aesthetics and purity projection. I mean, Stinker, right. Pinker talks about music as auditory cheesecake. Is one of them.
Right.
It's something that, you know, then in other words, is purely a matter of taste.
Right.
Yeah. The idea that this is great music and that that's great music, that can't really make sense. And then, curious enough, I read all his books, and it's very interesting. He had this, total takedown of people who think that there are these distinctions of a kind that really absolutely shadowed Bourdieu, but he didn't mention Bourdieu in book one. Then I saw the later book, somebody got onto it, and Bourdieu's La Distinction, who claims that, and the French middle class, all these people that say we listen to Beethoven recount and so on. It's all an attempt simply to build themselves up as being, the real people and the other people as not being so. Well, his first reaction, as it were, to claims there's something more to music than this was simply, well, this is one of these moves. Thorstein Veblen came in. So, but I want to try to explain the deep reasons why you can have no other view but the projectionist view. If you are doing reduction two, reduction one becomes not a free move, a force move. I mean, it has to belong to the system. So that, the whole thing brings me to a point where we could have a discussion. Because then you're making a very strong argument that we can't really run our lives from the first person standpoint
without
as though that were the case. We can't. So there's a real difficulty here that we can't.
You can't really have agency without the world demanding it of us, as it were. Right. Yeah. Charles's first book was on the explanation of human behavior.
Yeah.
And I think it may have been the very early...
middle of 64 came out.
Right. But it was
maybe... It was my PhD thesis.
Right. So people like Winch and Meldon and all those people wrote after you.
Yes. Yes. I mean, but not necessarily, they were slightly different. I mean, we were not that far apart, but they were
slight differences, yeah.
Very Wittgensteinian. I was Merleau-Ponty. Merleau-Ponty, so a little bit disguised. And
they were all influenced.
And they were all, these various sources that you can get this set of insights out of,
But it's related to some of the themes of the buffered self and all that we've been talking about. It's sort of the reductions of the mind which force this buffering, and it's just the other side of loss of value and meaning.
We thank Professor Emeritus Charles Taylor and Professor Akhil Bilgrami for their conversation. While on the way out of the studio, I had the opportunity to ask one more question of Professor Taylor. I notice in our culture, we seem to be obsessed with death. There are images of death on advertisements, in the cinema. Television seems to have a predominance of murder stories. I notice many people wear clothing with images of death, such as skulls and crucifix, blood. One gentleman I noticed was wearing a hat with a skull and crossbones on it, with the word toxic written on the hat. I wondered what Professor Taylor thought of our death-obsessed culture.
There's several possible things, but there certainly is a very, very old human reaction, which was started off anyway in warrior castes, warrior, right? And that is to reverse the field of fear of death. I mean, in other words, to because it is such a fearful thing, to stand absolutely unmoved in it gives you a tremendous sense of power, if you can do that right. And, you know, we are lords of death. We deal death, but and we're willing to go any time in order to have this stance. So you've got things like, you know, the famous Prussian regiment of the 18th century, Death Head Regiment, right? And then this survivor of the Hitler regime, too. They were the skull. You know, the skull was right there. Mm-hmm. So there is a way of dealing with the fear of death, mm-hmm, which is a kind of resolute facing of it. You kind of reverse the feel of it. I mean, precisely what makes it fearful also makes it exhilarating if you take this resolutely, this stance. Now, I think that people are playing with that. See, I mean,
yeah,
you see, they're not doing, not really like these warriors who really, you know, were out there with their lives on the on the line. But people are, they get that kind of kick, they can get that kind of lift from that.
But I wonder, Chuck, how much, since we've desacralized, you see, we've been talking in the last hour or so about the desacralization of the world and nature.
Yeah.
The disenchantment of the world. But the fact is, we've desacralized life as well. Mm, yeah. The idea that you can go 5 miles up in the air and just bomb whole populations, you know, without seeing the spectacular thing down there, but it's just something, you know, it's just completely, you know, it's just, you know, populations, not people.
Yeah.
Right? And
collateral damage.
Collateral damage, etc. Right, so it's a totally detached view of life as well, not just the world, but of human life.
Rethinking Religion is a project of Columbia University's Institute for Religion, Culture, and Public Life in New York City. To hear the entire unedited conversation between Charles Taylor and Akhil Bilgrami, as well as a short summary edition, and for transcripts, visit our website at ircpl.org. I'm Norris J. Chumley for Rethinking Religion.